The IER podcast is produced by Creative Kin and sponsored by Thompson Solicitors. Thanks for listening.
There's an awful lot of working people in this country. We've got a population of about 68 million. 34 million of them are working people. So we're looking at just about half the population in work. It's very important that they should have a voice at the cabinet table.
Employers have emphasised this dismissal that's their concern, not the other stuff, not the sick pay or bereavement leave or things like that. It's the dismissal stuff. And what that tells me is that they just want to retain the right to hire and fire.
Welcome to the first in a series of six podcasts from the Institute of Employment Rights. My name is Carolyn Jones. I'm Senior Vice President of IER, and I'm joined today by Lord John Hendy KC and Professor Keith Ewing, the Chair and President of IER. Welcome to you both. John, Keith, the Institute has a respected history of producing timely and informative reports and commentary, and today is no exception. In fact, as we record this, the Labour Party is publishing its promised employment rights bill. We've heard the headlines, but obviously we're not in a position to discuss the details of that bill today. But we can consider the ideas behind the bill and identify the fundamental principles that you both think should underpin the future framework of UK law. So, on the ideas behind the bill, I have to say that you have both led the way in changing the narrative and offering transformational policy proposals around labour law. You first offered a comprehensive new framework of labour law way back in 1996 in a book called Working Life, edited by Keith. That was followed in 2002 by a Charter of Workers' Rights and in 2013 by the Manifesto for Collective Bargaining. Unfortunately, while those works won the support of a majority of trade unions, the ideas remained on the shelf until, of course, Jeremy Corbyn became leader and, working with Laura Pidcock, your 2016 Manifesto for Labour Law was embraced. And your 2018 rolling out the Manifesto for Labour Law was incorporated into Corbyn's election manifesto. Things could have been so very different. But you, John, then went on to become the legal advisor to Andy MacDonald MP, who was at that time working with trade unions to draft a new deal for working people, which became the basis for the latest Labour Party version called Making Work Pay. Reflecting on that history, perhaps we can start by looking at why you think UK labour law needs to be so fundamentally rewritten.
I think you've got to go back to the election of Margaret Thatcher in 1979 with the introduction of the philosophies of neoliberalism and so on. There was a transformational change to industrial relations and employment law over a series of six or seven acts in the course of the 1980s and the beginning of the 1990s. And what that did was transform the power of workers and trade unions. And the consequence of that has been that the working class today are in a much worse position than they were in the 1970s. I mean, just to take one example, the value of real wages has been stagnant for at least 15 years now. So people's standards of living are getting worse generally than they were before. And that is a reflection of the loss of power of working people at work. Of course, there are other factors as well: deindustrialization, globalization, outsourcing, privatization, and so on. But they were all part of the neoliberal package. So what we set out to do in the Institute, particularly Keith and myself, if I may say so, and you, Cad, was to see if we couldn't formulate a set of proposals for industrial relations and employment law, what we call labour law, which would reverse the situation, give more power to workers at work.
Yeah, the history, I think, is spot on. And I think it leads us to where we are today. I mean, we're looking at these employment rights issues are not abstract questions that we're examining, but they're kind of rooted in a reality. And that reality is today, it's a reality of low pay, growing inequality, insecure jobs, great power in the employer. Employers are free to rip up contracts, fire and rehire, as it's sometimes referred to. We've seen the cutting back in levels of collective bargaining coverage. And of course, we've seen the disempowerment of trade unions with all the legal restrictions on the right to strike. So the question for us, I think, is how we go about dealing with or responding to this. And so a lot of our work over the last 30 years or so has been kind of developing a framework which would deal with these problems, which continue to grow in the absence of any effective regulation. We could come on and discuss some of the basic principles that we thought were appropriate and which we would hope a Labour government would pick up on. But let me just mention four of these. One is the idea that labour rights should be universal. They should apply equally to everybody. It's not just a question of day one rights, but it's also this whole question about employment status and the exclusion of people because they are misclassified or wrongly classified or non-classified as employees or workers. Second issue, I think, which is critical, is the need to restore collective bargaining coverage to levels which we experienced in this country in the past. So you go back to the 1970s, just before the period John was speaking about, so we're looking at 80-plus workers covered by a collective agreement. Now, that's important because collective bargaining coverage goes to equality and it goes to higher wages. So the third issue, I think, which we've also emphasised, is the need to comply with international legal standards and the violations thereof by successive British governments, which are still to be addressed, but that goes to trade union power. And then the fourth issue is the question, which is often overlooked, I think, is a question of remedies and enforcement. We have a system of employment law in this country historically that does not pay enough attention to remedies and what the responsibility of the employer is when the employer acts badly. And we saw that in the P&O case. In a sense, employers basically have an impunity from any form of legal liability when they violate workers' rights. So I think a lot of the work that we've been doing, I think a lot of the focus has been on these, not exclusively, but a lot of the focus on these four questions. And that's what I would like to see addressed by this government.
You've mentioned the IER's Manifesto for Labour Law, and you've just gone through some of the main key elements, the work that you've produced previously. How do you think the New Deal differs from IER's proposals?
The New Deal certainly takes the main element of the proposals that the Institute was making. There are one or two things that it didn't deal with. One is that we've always been strong advocates for the restoration of a Ministry of Labour. That's to say, a Secretary of State in the Cabinet whose responsibility is to look after working people. And it often seems to me to need to be said again that there's an awful lot of working people in this country. We've got a population, I think the latest statistic came out 2 days ago, about 68 million, but 34 million of them are working people, 4 and a bit million self-employed and 29 and a bit million employees. So we're looking at just about half the population in work. And then, of course, there are all those who are dependent on those who are in work, which encompasses most of the other half of the population. It's very important that they should have a voice at the cabinet table. For example, today we've had the announcements on the radio and the television about the Employment Rights Bill, which unfortunately we haven't been able to get a copy of yet. But the voice of business is being heard all the time in the media, but not the voice of the working people who are likely to most benefit from this. So that was one proposal that we've been insistent on. And I have to remind those that have forgotten that the UK was the first country in the world to have a Ministry of Labour, and most other countries have got a Ministry of Labour now. Every European country, the United States, Canada, South Africa, Japan, but we haven't, which means that it's fallen on the very broad shoulders of the Secretary of State for Business to launch the package today.
Well, the issue there, I think, is that the New Deal has been watered down quite a lot. So you go back to the document that was approved by a Labour Party conference in 2021. And that was a fairly robust document, I think, which would meet a lot of the expectations you would reasonably have of a Labour government, and I think would make us very happy in terms of its content. I mean, there was stuff about a commitment to universal coverage of employment law. There was a strong commitment to sector-wide collective bargaining and to reform of the trade union recognition procedure. But you know, beyond that, there was also a commitment to give effect to international labour standards. I mean, not just in relation to the recent Strikes Act on minimum service levels, but to all the stuff that we've inherited and which the last Labour government did nothing about, inherited from the Thatcher governments in the 1980s. A lot of that stuff was there, but as John said, the commitment to a Ministry of Labour has gone. I don't think it appeared in the 2021 document. Now, I think that's really a huge loss, but you know, for the reasons that John has explained, everybody else seems to be represented at the heart of governments. And to have their own department. And that is critical, that there is a department with a civil service which is committed to promoting a particular interest in government. And in this case, it's the interest of workers. So there's nobody, with the exception of Angela Rayner, who doesn't have a Labour department behind her or a huge civil service team that existed in the past. There is no institutional presence in government of the trade union or worker interest. And I think that's a major, major
defect. And one of the main roles for such a ministry would be to oversee the rolling out of sectoral collective bargaining across the economy, which would be good for the economy, which would be good for workers, give workers a voice in where that's being reduced to maybe sectoral collective bargaining in the adult social care sector. We don't know if and when it's going to be rolled out. Any thoughts on that? Do you think it will get back on the agenda?
Yeah, I think that's a very important point that you've raised, because although we don't know what's in the bill now, what we do know is that the Labour Party have made absolutely clear that they're not going to roll out sectoral collective bargaining for each sector of the economy, which was a key proposal of the Institute for the last 30 years and in the New Deal for Working People. The proposal at the moment, so far as one can see from the government press release, is for a fair pay agreement for adult social work and the restitution of school support staff, the restitution of their collective national joint council. But there are many, many other sectors which are absolutely crying out for sectoral collective bargaining to prevent bad employers undercutting good ones and to ensure that standards are brought up to a decent standard for all working people and applicable to all employers within the sector.
Yeah, I think if I could plug the Institute's blog site, we've got a good blog on sectoral collective bargaining. But basically, the plan initially was that this would be a kind of universal commitment. I mean, just like there is at the moment in the European Union, there is something called the Adequate Minimum Wage Directive, which imposes an obligation on every country, every member state, to have in place a policy that will reach 80% coverage of density of collective agreements. Now, that is an extraordinary obligation and an extraordinary commitment, which I guess we were quite close to back in 2021, and we could probably have at least kept up with what is happening in the EU in that respect. But also, I get the sense, well, let's not walk before we run, let's pilot this initiative over a number of sectors, which is what the government's commitment is. But I think you need to go beyond adult social care. In a sense, what we also need is something in the private sector to see how you could rebuild sectoral collective bargaining in a private sector in an area where there is very low levels of union coverage, where there are questions about low labour standards, and people are being exploited. So the question is, what extent could we put something in place? Let's take a sector and use that as a template for an experiment, if you like, for this purpose and see what lessons can be learned from that. But at the end of the day, it's about political power. And it comes back to the question of a government minister. I mean, one of the things which the Ministry of Labour did in the past, after it was set up in 1916 and after various governments of different political persuasions committed to sectoral bargaining across the economy, part of the job of the Ministry of Labour was to create the structures and to encourage and persuade, cajole employers and unions to take part, to create a constitutional machinery for every industry in the country. So, in a sense, the role of a Ministry of Labour is, as you say, Cad, one of the principal purposes is to rebuild that machinery. And the reason why we don't have one is because we're so deregulated. In a sense, there's no space that a minister would fill, because our labour law system is just so impoverished now. It is so deregulated. But we need, if we're going to take this seriously, we need to have a government department committed to workers and trade unions and committed also to creating the institutional framework in which that protection could be best fulfilled.
Just to say a word about the sectors that need sectoral bargaining, there are many candidates that could be mentioned, particularly in the private sector, food delivery, hospitality and so on. But one that really sticks out to me is agriculture. Because agriculture did have sectoral bargaining established by law from the 1920s right through until 2013, when it was abolished by the Tories. And it's a sector where you've got massive exploitation, human trafficking, human slavery and so on, seasonal work, people with insecure contracts at 0 hours and all the rest of it. If we could restore sector-wide bargaining for that sector, it would do an awful lot for a lot of people who are living in misery at the moment. Even in the public sector, where there is still extant sectoral bargaining, in many sectors, such as primary and secondary education, there is no sectoral bargaining over wages. So that needs to be restored as well.
And the government could lead the way. It could lead by example by restoring sectoral bargaining in the civil service. So we have, you know, an appropriate form of collective bargaining for the, you know, tens, if not hundreds of thousands of people who are now engaged in the civil service. The other areas are the so-called gig economy areas. I mean, the guys who are now delivering food, food delivery workers, people who are warehousing, all these new companies now which are dominating these sectors, which are union-free and basically dictating terms and conditions of employment. So there are opportunities, but we need the political will if these opportunities are to be seized.
And sectoral collective bargaining does obviously open up opportunities and provide a voice for workers in the workplace. But we all know that the other side of collective bargaining is collective action and the need to be able to take collective action, which we've seen restricted over the years by the legislation. We've heard today on news items an awful lot about individual rights going to be included in the bill, sick pay, maternity, paternity. I've not heard very much about collective rights. Where do you think that might be, and what is the importance of making sure that trade unions are given power once again?
One of the things that was in the New Deal, I think Keith mentioned it earlier, was a commitment that the law on industrial action in the United Kingdom should comply with the international treaty obligations, which the United Kingdom has voluntarily ratified. Those are primarily within the International Labour Organization, the ILO, key conventions, Convention 87 and 98, which regulate the right to strike and the right to bargain collectively, and the European Social Charter of 1961, which is nothing to do with the European Union, but part of the Council of Europe, which is also responsible for the European Convention on Human Rights. And the European Social Charter has got specific provision for the protection of the right to strike. Now, the point is that those treaties binding on the UK, those treaties are supervised by various supervisory bodies, which have, on every single occasion in which they've considered the UK law on industrial action, found found that our law was not in compliance with our treaty obligations. And the New Deal for Working People specifically said that the new legislation should make provision for our law to comply with international obligations. Now, obviously, we wait to see what's in the employment bill, but the signs are that that is not a commitment which the government is going to persist with. And that's very sad. And it's very important too, because if unions don't have the power to take industrial action or threaten industrial action, then they've got no leverage in collective bargaining. If they've got no leverage in collective bargaining, then workers have got even less leverage in individual bargaining, which means that currently, 3/4 of the working population have got no say whatsoever over the terms and conditions on which they work.
I think a good example of that was the P&O Ferries case, which we mustn't allow to slip from memory. And that was the case 2022, in case people have forgotten, where about 800 workers employed by P&O were instantly dismissed and replaced by agency workers recruited from India by a company based in Malta. And so they replaced the sacked workers and were clearly being paid terms and conditions of employment which were vastly inferior to the collectively agreed terms and conditions which the dismissed seafarers were being paid. Now, that there are two issues about that case which are striking. One is that the RMT and Nautilus, the two unions, made a complaint to the International Labour Organization, which is the body which supervises the operation of international law. And they came forward and repeated the request to the British government that you've got to relax the restraints on trade unions, and in particular to allow trade unions to engage in sympathy action to support each other when one is in distress. And that message was quite clear. I mean, we've been in breach of this obligation now since, 1990, if not before. The other points about the case was that if the union had the right to take sympathy action or ask others to join it and to take sympathy action in support of the union and their members whose collective agreements were being traduced by the company, then the union would have had some leverage on the company and we would have been able to put some industrial pressure, get the company around the table, let's start talking about this, get these dismissal notices removed. So it's not an abstract issue, this. It has real life consequences, the fact that trade unions are disempowered, denied any leverage. Now, what the government, I think, is proposing, what I read in the newspapers, is that the ferry companies operating to and from British ports will be required to pay at least the minimum wage. So the agency workers, in this case, will be entitled at least to the minimum wage. We can welcome that, but it's not really good enough, because in a sense, this is minimum wage versus what were previously wages determined by collective agreements. So in a sense, it was an example of de-unionisation by a company which could not be held accountable to the wider trade union movement because they have been so disempowered by law. And I would say to the Labour government, you've got to trust workers and their unions to help themselves in these situations. If you want to stop this from happening, then workers should have the power through their unions to act in support and solidarity with each other.
I think that P&O Ferries case is incredibly important because it demonstrated that the employer, who was bound by a law which required it to consult with the unions before dismissing people, could say, well, the law can get stuffed since we can calculate what the maximum will be because of the limits on compensation. We're prepared to pay that because we think we can recover that by hiring a cheaper crew. So the employer regards the law as a matter of choice. But so far as the workers are concerned, they are constrained by the law, which they've got no option not to comply with in not asking the dock workers or the refuelers of the ship to boycott the ship until the dispute was resolved.
It's really important, I think, to emphasise the fact that the company in that case thought it could act with impunity, just ignore the law. And that speaks to one of the priorities that we have emphasised over the years. And it highlights the weakness. I mean, we have a system of labour law which confers certain rights, in this case to be informed and consulted before redundancy, but there are no effective remedies. So, in a sense, the employer could choose not to follow through the procedures, but we'll throw some money at those who are affected as a result. And what we need are legal powers to stop decisions which are taken without complying with legal obligations, to stop dismissals that take place in breach of procedures or because they're otherwise not lawful. The big thing that's missing in our system is a power to restrain the employer. And it's not good enough to have a framework which simply compensates after the event for a job lost, a life ruined. There has to be a power to stop the employer. And if you contrast the position with trade unions, when trade unions break the law, there's no question there of trade unions then being asked to compensate after the event. The employer can get an injunction immediately to have the unlawful action in which the trade union is engaged, to have that action stopped. So the union in the P&O case had organised sympathy action. It would have been restrained by an injunction. But we can't do the same to the employer, whose decisions actually set in train this series of events. And the other thing on enforcement, just compare the way in which we treat employers and the lack of any punitive sanction that can be visited on employers, no matter how grievous the activity. You compare that with the powers available to the Information Commissioner's Office or to the Financial Services Authority to whack big fines on companies that violate these different areas of the law. Why don't we have the same in labour law? So the companies that were involved in a blacklisting scandal or companies like P&O, why are they not visited by these massive fines of the kind that we see operating in other areas? But it just speaks to the extent to which workers' rights have been degraded in this country. And the employment bill may help, but it won't in any way take us back to where we need to be.
One of the recommendations of the ILO in the P&O Ferries case was that there should be sufficiently dissuasive remedies available for breach of employment rights. And that's one of the things that was reflected in the New Deal for Working People, which recommended that all limits on compensation, statutory limits which are arbitrary, should be removed so that workers would be entitled to the full measure of loss caused by whatever the unlawful act of the employer was. That would help enormously. But there are some other measures as well which perhaps we should just mention, and one of them is in public procurement. That's to say that governments letting contracts or giving grants or granting licenses or whatever should ensure that the essential elements of labour law are complied with, including the right to bargain collectively and the duty to recognise unions for collective bargaining. That's pretty standard in the rest of Europe, but it's not here. And the most recent public procurement legislation excludes considerations for labour welfare or international standards. Now, I don't think that the Employment Rights Bill published today will say anything about that, but it's a very important measure. And it's got a long history in this country, going back to 1896, the first Fair Wages Resolution of the House of Commons saying that all public contractors ought to comply with the locally agreed rates.
The difference that would make if that was introduced. We've covered a lot of issues on the principles behind and the fundamentals. There was an item on the radio today about the difference between day one rights, which we have been calling for, and probation periods, which it was suggested is going to be announced as 9 months. Obviously, we haven't seen the bill, so the detail we can't comment on, but there seems to be a lot of confusion about the difference between a day one right and a probation period. Quick comment on that.
Well, we've done a blog on that, so it's on the Institute website. I can't see why the government needs to regulate probation periods at all. Probation periods are normally a matter of contract between the employer and the worker. But unfair dismissal law, which will come into effect from day one, which we ought to congratulate the government for doing, already makes provision for the employment tribunal to take into account all the circumstances of the case and to decide the question of fairness or unfairness as a matter of what reasonable employers would do. Well, reasonable employers with a probation period would obviously expect a slightly lesser standard to be upheld against them than in respect of workers that haven't got a probation period. The unfair dismissal legislation already takes account of circumstances such as the existence of a probation period. Lastly, just on that, I can't see the justification for a 9-month probation period.
I mean, most compromise, people, isn't it, between two politicians, one wanted 6, one wanted 12 months.
I mean, how is that going to apply in the construction industry when people are hired to build a house within 6 months?
Yeah.
They'll never, ever not have a probation period hanging over their heads.
There'll be a scope for a good amendment from you and the Lords on that, John, obviously.
That brings us to a different issue.
Well, I was just going to say that if you are a new recruit, you've been working for up to 6 months or 9 months at the moment, you can be dismissed if you're not measuring up, or if you've engaged in some form of misconduct or a redundancy, you can be dismissed. There's no problem. And if the nature of the short period of the employment, the fact that it might be a small employer, these will all be taken into account by the tribunal. So I just find it hard to understand what the objection to day one rights is from a practical, never mind a principled perspective. And employers have emphasised this dismissal that's their concern, not the other stuff, not the sick pay or bereavement leave or things like that. It's the dismissal stuff. And what that tells me is that they just want to retain the right to hire and fire unconstrained. So I've got no sympathy for that position.
Good. We've discussed a lot. Are there any final points that you would like to make?
A moment ago you mentioned the possibility of an amendment in the House of Lords, and obviously we don't know the full shape of this bill, but the suggestion has been made that it will be a rather skeletal bill with not much of substance in it, but giving powers to the relevant minister to bring in the detailed regulation by statutory instruments, which the lawyers call secondary legislation. And I think that presents a major problem, because under parliamentary rules, you can't amend a draft statutory instrument. You can vote against it, but you can't amend it, which means that Parliament, including the House of Lords, will not be able to exercise any supervisory role in amending the substance of the legislation. It will only be the bill itself where amendments can be made. And if the bill doesn't say very much other than granting powers to ministers, then I think there's a democratic problem here, because legislation ought to be subject to potential amendments.
I think the Blair government lost some of its secondary legislation on House of Lords votes. And it would be salutary, I think, if this government were to lose some of its employment law secondary legislation in the House of Lords. There could yet be quite a big political battle, not just on the content, but also on the procedures which the government seems set to adopt. So in a sense, it'll keep us busy for 5 years or so anyway.
Absolutely, and I guess a lot of it will depend on what attitude the trade unions take, and to what extent they want to stand up and make their voices heard in terms of what the government, the content, and as you say, the procedure. Well, as you say, we shall see. Thank you, John and Keith, for your informed thoughts on the future of UK labour law. I have to thank Thompson's too for their sponsorship of this podcast series, and thanks to the listeners for being part of our new podcast initiative. This first series of 6 podcasts will analyse the proposed changes to employment law, including a detailed look of the contents of today's employment rights bill. Our experts will talk us through the contents of the bill, guide us through the expected consultation papers, and highlight the possibilities and problems for workers and their trade unions. So please join us and be part of that debate.
This podcast is sponsored by Thompson Solicitors, and it's produced for the Institute of Employment Rights by Creative Kin. To find out more, visit creativekin.co.uk/IER.